From ABC News, World News This Week. I'm Dorothy McIntyre, ABC News. Listen.
We entered so fast, some of the subjects said they didn't realize strangers were in the bomb factory until they had the handcuffs being put on them.
I just heard a very loud explosion, and then I heard very painful, loud screams.
The Senate being equally divided, the Vice President votes in the affirmative, and the bill, H.R. 2264, is passed.
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's world news.
There were two out, bottom of the ninth, tying run on third, and the MVP was at the plate. I threw two curves that broke like dive bombers. And then I threw my heat. Even if he saw it, there was no way he could hit it. Not bad pitching for the only 12-year-old girl all-star in our little league. That was the first time the guys ever gave me five. I even got five from the kid I struck out. I've never forgotten how great that felt because I'm still giving five to the kids. 5 hours a week and 5% of my income is the goal I set for myself to help others, to give back something I was lucky enough to have. So no matter what charity or cause you're giving to now, give a little more. Give five. Because if you've ever faced down a 365 hitter man to man, you'd know the taste of victory is much sweeter than defeat. So give five to someone who needs your help to feel like a winner. For more information, call 1-800-55-GIVE-5. That's 1-800-55-GIVE-5.
A message from Independent Sector and the Ad Council.
It was about 4 months ago that the World Trade Center in New York was rocked by an explosion. This past Thursday, U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White announced,
"We have today arrested and charged 8 defendants with a conspiracy and the attempted bombing of the United Nations 26 Federal Plaza and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels."
Although it was not part of that complaint, the FBI had warned some officials that they also were on a hit list. Among them, New York Senator Al D'Amato.
"They did indicate that I, as well as some others and some targets, without going into details, that there were some other targets."
Which included a New York State Assemblyman, the President of Egypt, and the UN Secretary General. As in the case of the Trade Center bombing last February, the latest suspects are said to be Muslim extremists. The FBI identifies their leader as Siddiq Ibrahim Siddiq Ali. And according to ABC's Richard Davies,
"Information from a confidential informant played a crucial role in the arrests. The document describes Siddiq Ibrahim Siddiq Ali as a central figure in the conspiracy, saying he suggested to the informant that a bomb be put in a car which would be driven to the United Nations complex and blown up."
Security is tight at the UN, but ABC's Ted Koppel says the group had contacts which would make their job easier.
"Two men from the Sudanese mission were going to provide diplomatic license plates to Siddiq Ali, who was also from Sudan, so that he could drive a rented car filled with explosives into the UN garage."
A car bomb is what was used at the World Trade Center, and ABC's Morton Dean says,
"Law enforcement agents claim that explosives being concocted by the group arrested were generically similar to those that were used at the World Trade Center. Also, the FBI claims a confidential informant learned that two of those arrested were involved in preparations for the World Trade Center bombing. They had tested some bombing devices. ABC News learned that law enforcement officials had long been interested in at least two of those arrested and that they had been questioned about a possible link to the February 26th bombing at the World Trade Center."
FBI Assistant Director James Fox says five of the suspects were caught as they mixed the explosives, a foul-smelling brew of fertilizer and fuel oil.
"We entered so fast, some of the subjects said they didn't realize strangers were in the bomb factory until they had the handcuffs being put on them."
The FBI thinks the gang was close to putting its plan into effect, perhaps as early as the 4th of July. A date like that and the targets mentioned would fit into terrorist patterns of making attacks of a symbolic nature. The men arrested in the Trade Center bombing are said to be followers of Omar Abdel Rahman. He is the Muslim sheikh living in this country who advocates the violent overthrow of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Rahman says he doesn't know any of them, but says he does know the alleged ringleader of the group arrested this week. Through a translator, Rahman told reporters that Sadiq Ali was his interpreter for about 6 months.
I don't know anything about him, but he is a very good English. He speaks English fluently. And he was a very good translator.
The Sheikh denied knowing anything about the Trade Center bombing or the plans of this newest group.
I condemn any act that will hurt the national security or the security of America or the Americans.
The FBI raided the Sheikh's apartment looking for evidence of his involvement in the latest incident. The New York Daily News says audio tapes of Rahman recorded by the informant in the case was the basis for the raid. Several published reports identify the informant as Imad Salem, a former Egyptian military officer who occasionally was the Sheikh's bodyguard and translator. Authorities have been trying to get the Sheikh deported on grounds that he lied on his application for entry into the U.S. New York Governor Mario Cuomo says it's just too easy for undesirables to get into this country, since all they have to do is apply for political asylum.
All the asylum laws are a joke. We all know that. It's not just the Sheikh. That just made it dramatic. You come in, you say asylum. They say, okay, it'll take us a year to figure out whether or not you're telling us the truth. Meanwhile, go down to South Jamaica and get yourself a job. They disappear. It's a joke. That has to be changed.
President Clinton says that's the burden of a democracy, and because of that,
any free society has always some exposure to terrorism. I think what the American people should do, though, is to feel an enormous sense of pride in the aggressive work done by the New York Police Department and all the federal authorities involved.
As U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White put it,
the leader of these terrorists, as reflected in the complaint filed today, has said, we can get you anytime. Law enforcement's answer is, no, you cannot.
The New York case was a bombing that almost was. Two university professors were not so lucky. They were seriously injured by mail bombs. One was sent to Dr. Charles Epstein, the head of the Medical Genetics Division at the University of California in San Francisco. FBI agent Bud Covert describes the bomb.
This brown package was approximately 8 inches by 11 inches by 2.5 inches and was of a padded envelope variety.
A couple of days after the incident in San Francisco, a computer scientist at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, opened his mail. Linda Jones was nearby.
I just heard a very loud explosion, and then I heard very painful, loud screams.
As David Galanter was being treated for his injuries, someone made a phone call to a VA hospital in New Haven, where Galanter's brother, Joel, is on the medical staff. Louise Fitzsimmons works at the hospital.
We received an anonymous telephone call to our switchboard saying, you are next. Not specifically directed against any individual, just those words, you are next.
Who's been sending the letter bombs? The FBI has linked this week's letter bombs to a dozen similar attacks at universities and high-tech companies since 1978. Reporter Al Jones has more from New Haven.
Federal agents are baffled as to why the serial bomber is back. The FBI's Milt Ulrich says they don't have a motive or common thread connecting the Yale University and University of California attacks with 12 others since 1978, but it is the same bomber.
There are several aspects of it that are unique to this maker. Certainly we're not going to discuss this in any detail here, but there are things from bomb to bomb to bomb that have similar characteristics.
Ulrich says the bomber uses fake return addresses and extra postage on the book-sized packages. Al Jones for ABC News, New Haven, Connecticut.
After weeks of cajoling, deal-making, jaw-boning, and arm-twisting, President Clinton's budget bill came up for Senate consideration, and the final vote was so close you could almost hear it squeaking through.
On this vote, the yeas are 49, the nays are 49, the Senate being equally divided. The vice president votes in the affirmative, and the bill, H.R. 2264, is passed.
As ABC's Vic Ratner tells us,
it took a marathon 18-hour session of the Senate and Vice President Al Gore's very early in the morning tie-breaking vote to give the Democrats a victory. Later, Gore tried not to be bitter about the half-dozen Democrats who deserted the president in the clutch.
I'll just bet you that this time next year, those who voted for this plan are going to say, we had the courage to bite the bullet and make this economic recovery possible.
The Senate bill includes virtually the same increases in personal and corporate tax rates as the House version, but a much smaller tax on gasoline.
President Clinton was obviously pleased.
What this means is incalculable. It means we can now move on to a conference committee with a clear signal to the financial markets that its interest rates should stay down and people should be able to continue to refinance their homes and finance their businesses at lower interest rates.
That is not how Senate Republican leader Bob Dole sees it.
The president's tried to make this a defining moment of his presidency. He's right. It is and will be for years to come. He's already earned his place on Mount Taxmore.
The next battle begins after the July 4th recess, when Senate and House negotiators try to resolve the differences between their two versions of the budget bill. Funding for that multi-billion-dollar science project, the Super Collider, came up in the House during the week.
The yeas were 280, the nays were 150, and the amendment is agreed to.
In this case, a yay vote was to kill the project, and freshman members of Congress led the charge, heeding the plea of Wisconsin Democrat David Obey.
It's time to say enough. The deficits are too big, other needs are too urgent. The Super Collider might be nice to have someday, but for now we need to put it on the shelf until we can afford it.
But the Super Collider project has been killed before and has managed to survive, and so it could again when the Senate takes up the issue. Also up for a House vote, funding for NASA's space station, which has cost more than $9 billion so far without producing any hardware ready to fly. Michigan Republican Fred Upton argued for its defeat.
Do you remember the old Muppet TV show? Pigs in space. Do you remember that? Well, maybe this space station ought to be the star attraction on a congressional version of a show called Pork in Space.
Fellow Republican James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin was among those supporting the project.
Without the manned space program, we would not have had a revolution in telecommunications, which has made long-distance telephone calls dirt cheap. We would not have had the development of medications that have eased pain and extended the life expectancy of people in this country and around the world.
By just one vote, the House approved the space station. It could be killed later on when another vote on overall NASA funding comes up. While the House was deciding the fate of the yet unbuilt space station, the shuttle Endeavour and its crew of six were circling the Earth on another mission. The main job of their eight-day mission was to pluck a 4.5-ton Eureka satellite from orbit and bring it home. The attempt came on Thursday, and here's how it turned out.
Endeavour was captured.
Endeavour, Eureka. There's a lot of smiling faces down here. And you can probably hear everybody clapping.
A couple of antennas on the satellite were loose, so two of the astronauts, who were scheduled to walk in space anyway, did a little maintenance while they were out there. And ground control was happy to report.
We have declared victory. Both of the antennas are now latched.
From there, astronauts Jeff Weisoff and David Lowe spent about 6 hours walking in space, experimenting with tools and procedures that'll be used to fix the Hubble Space Telescope later this year. And how about billboards in space? Apparently, some companies think it would be a good idea, but Democratic Congressman Edward Markey is leading the effort to ban that kind of advertising.
Every sunrise and sunset would beam down the logo of Coke or GM or the Marlboro Man, would turn our morning and evening skies, often a source of inspiration and comfort, into the moral equivalent of the side of a bus.
Markey's legislation would prohibit issuing launch licenses to anyone who plans to put a billboard in the heavens. There were thousands of nervous people on the ground all over the country as the Military Base Closing Commission began to announce which installations would stay in operation and which would not. Among the first to get the news were Alabama's Fort McClellan and the Anniston Army Training Installation. Anniston Mayor David Dethridge breathed a sigh of relief when word came that both would stay open.
We want to do what's in the best interest of our country. We're all good Americans, and we were prepared to move forward if we had faced a closure, but we are very thankful that we're not on that list.
Neither was Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. That base had been heavily damaged by Hurricane Andrew, and it was thought that rebuilding it might be too expensive. But as ABC's Peter Danch told us,
when several members of the base closing commission toured the Homestead Air Force Base, they said two of the top factors to be considered were a base's strategic value and its impact on the economy. Local officials said with the base's proximity to Cuba and its location here in South Florida, it had such value, and it also accounted for nearly 9,000 jobs a year and represented a third of Homestead's economy.
Many other well-known bases were on the hit list, and Commission Chairman James Corder said,
"There's no perfect way to spread the pain. There's clearly going to be some states that do not feel the negative economic impact as much as others. But on the other hand, what we have to do is to mightily strive towards serving the national good at the expense sometimes for the local interest."
The list of recommendations goes to President Clinton, who has until July 15th to accept or reject it. Acceptance means it goes to Congress, which then has 45 days to vote yes or no. Rejection by the president means the base closing commission has an additional month to change the list and resubmit it to Mr. Clinton. Among the decisions the U.S. Supreme Court made this week, one involving the civil rights of workers. The 5-4 ruling makes it harder for employees to prove they've been discriminated against in cases of dismissal or denial of a job or a job promotion. In an 8-1 decision, the court upheld the Bush and Clinton administration's policy of intercepting Haitians at sea and returning them to Haiti without asylum hearings. ABC Law correspondent Tim O'Brien explains the court's thinking.
Over the years, the High Court has been extremely reluctant to tie any president's hands in matters of immigration policy, and today's ruling is consistent with that tradition. Justice John Paul Stevens, for an 8-justice majority, pointed out that the court wasn't considering the wisdom of the policy, only the legality, and it found no basis in federal law or in U.S. treaty obligations to invalidate the interdiction of Haitians on the high seas. The significance of the decision extends beyond Haiti, strengthening the administration's hand in dealing with those seeking to enter the U.S. illegally from wherever they may come. Tim O'Brien, ABC News at the Supreme Court.
President Clinton has named a former state health commissioner, Christine Gebbie, to head his panel on AIDS policy. Gebbie, who last served as the health commissioner in Washington State, will oversee a $2.7 billion effort to fight the disease.
"We've all been working the balancing act of this epidemic for a long time, balancing an investment in research with our investment in applying that research in a sensible way, and our investments in caring for people who already have the disease with an investment in preventing further spread, with an investment in the health-related aspects of this disease, with all of the other pieces, the education, the business, the community levels of response that have to be a part of it."
While some groups like ACT UP are not pleased with Gebbie's appointment, the AIDS Action Council, which is an umbrella organization of AIDS advocacy groups, approves. Leading forces in the tobacco industry are suing the government, asking that it overturn the EPA's declaration that secondhand smoke causes cancer. Steve Parrish, a senior executive with Philip Morris, says the agency changed the rules of its tests to fit the results it wanted to achieve.
EPA failed to follow its own publicly announced guidelines for conducting cancer risk assessments. Very simply, when the guidelines would not allow for the EPA's preconceived and predetermined conclusions, the guidelines were ignored.
Not so, says EPA head Carol Browner.
"It's the agency's view that secondhand smoke can cause health problems. The agency undertook a study. We stand by that study."
In Los Angeles, outgoing Mayor Tom Bradley has signed a landmark bill that, with some exceptions, bans smoking in all of the city's 7,000 restaurants. Another big city mayor had an announcement to make during the week.
"I've decided 20 years is enough. I shall not seek another term as mayor of Detroit."
Coleman Young is 75 and said that his age and health considerations led to his decision. More than a dozen candidates have already declared their intentions to run for his job. Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon had a sad announcement to make on the Senate floor this past Tuesday. A longtime friend of his had died.
"I just received word that Mrs. Richard Nixon has passed away, having suffered for many years with emphysema, and understand the cause of death was given as lung cancer."
For 53 years, Pat Nixon was the loyal and uncomplaining partner in Richard Nixon's triumphs and defeats. While she didn't have much influence over her husband's policies, political historian Carl Anthony says the former First Lady did stand up for her beliefs.
"Pat Nixon was the first
first lady to use the word abortion in the context of saying that she was pro-choice on abortion, that she was the first to call for a woman on the Supreme Court and actually argued with her husband about that.
After hearing of her death, President Clinton issued this statement.
I think the American people really appreciate the dignity with which she served as first lady. And I hope and believe that the Nixon family has the thoughts and prayers of all the American people today.
Former President Nixon and his two daughters were with Mrs. Nixon when she died. She was 81. The sun set on any dreams the Phoenix Suns had about ending pro basketball's current dynasty. John Paxton's three-point shot with 4 seconds to go in Game 6 of the NBA championship gave the Chicago Bulls their third straight title. Is three-peating enough for MVP Michael Jordan?
No, it's never enough. It's okay. Never enough as long as you compete. You know, it's always great to win, but that's why you compete. And I think, we're going to certainly try to do this for the fourth time. You know, but right now in the third time was a lot of damn work.
The victory sent the faithful into the streets of Chicago. It was fine for a while, but as is so often the case these days, the joy of celebration turned into the agony of rioting. Three people were killed by gunshots. Chicago police made nearly 700 arrests. By contrast, Lee Janssen's far more subdued victory in the 93rd U.S. Open Golf Tournament in New Jersey. Janssen's 72-hole total tied the U.S. Open scoring record Jack Nicklaus set in 1980. How would you rate your boss? We'll tell you how a couple made out when World News This Week continues in a moment.
Are you off the phone yet?
Yeah, Mom, I'm off the phone.
The greatest lesson you can learn about education is that it shouldn't stop after school.
I don't believe this.
What?
Mom, it's 9 o'clock. Don't you ever get your head out of those books?
Look, I'm doing homework like you should be.
I already did it. Listen, I thought the whole reason to get out of school is so you'll never have to do homework again.
I could look at it that way, but then I'd be stuck in the same job all my life, doing the same thing. That's not what I want.
And what do you want?
Something better.
If you think homework is just for kids, you should see what it can do for your career. So keep learning, go back to school, get training, improve your job skills, and you'll find a whole new future waiting for you. It's as simple as ABC. Never stop learning. A message from Project Learning US, the ABC Radio Networks, and this station.
Jim Miller heads Miller Business Systems of Arlington, Texas, and he's written a book on proper management techniques. So, who better to run a contest to pick the country's best and worst bosses? Miller got hundreds of entries in both categories. We don't know the name of the person whose entry won the worst boss contest, for obvious reasons, and the boss's name was mercifully kept anonymous as well. But Miller told us a little about him.
He circulated a memo threatening immediate dismissal for any employee who was caught adjusting the office thermostat or radio. Another memo that if you go to a funeral, you've got to bring in a copy of the obituary and then verify what your relationship was to the person that was dead. Another time, constantly is gone by mid-afternoon, but always calls in at 4:55 to check to see who's left early, but he himself is always gone early.
No secret about the best boss, though. He is John Martin of the Dairy and Food Industry Supply Association. The employee who nominated him, Dorothy Mallory, gets a week's trip for two to Hawaii as her prize. Oh, the person who won for nominating the worst boss gets the same. And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longin, engineering by Tian Truong. I'm Dorothy McIntyre, ABC News, New York.
More Americans get their news from ABC News than from any other source.
790 KEBC Talk Radio time, 6:30, half past 6, 30 minutes in front of 7 o'clock, depending on how you want to look at it.